Okay, great. So this week I'm going to talk about mind. I'm going to talk about chitta. But before that, I just wanted to reiterate the, in some ways, the point of mindfulness. So so I often hear people, not necessarily you guys, but I hear people say a lot, oh, they can't meditate. Their like mind is too busy or something, or they don't have time or whatever. What I have heard is people say, I'm not doing it right or something. Whereas that actually, all of that's a bit of a misunderstanding. So, you know, what mindfulness is really is like noticing the mind that we actually have, not like the mind we think we should have or the mind we'd even like, but actually the mind that we've got now, which, let's face it, most of the time is like a washing machine, isn't it? Like we're with too many clothes stuffed in it. So, The whole point of mindfulness is to just notice that, notice the tumbling, notice the discomfort, you know, notice it churning around. So if you're experiencing that, if you're actually experiencing what's going on for you, then you're doing it right. Yeah, that's absolutely, you're doing it right. You don't need to worry about whether or not it's going well or not. Yeah, you just need to notice. That's the whole point of it. Our minds just go all over the place, yeah, like everyone's does, like mine does, you know, like everyone's does. Yeah, I'm sure even the Buddhas went all over the place for quite a long time, yeah. There are stories of the Buddha's enlightenment where he's assailed by demons and creatures and so on, which are sort of metaphors for his thoughts, you know, trying to attack him, right up to the very point of his enlightenment. So everybody's mind is like this. You know, you're not special, you don't have an overly busy mind. And what we're doing is we're just trying to do the best we can with that. Yeah, and sometimes that means it doesn't go very well. Sometimes it means you can't sit still. Sometimes it means that you're too irritated or angry to get much meditation done. But we're just going to keep trying to do that. So often what people, when people say that they can't meditate, what they really mean is they don't want to meditate. They don't really want to look at what's going on. But to me, this seems a bit silly, because the one thing that mediates all your experience is the mind. You know, it absolutely determines whether you have a positive or negative experience, whether it's pleasurable or unpleasurable. So to just ignore the fact that you've got this thing, which is the medium between everything, is to throw away the greatest power you have over it. So to me, it just seems like that's absolutely the thing we need to do. We need to look at our minds and see what they're doing, and then see how we can work with them. But the other thing to say is progress is not linear. Yeah, it's not linear. So we have this idea in our society that if we just keep doing something, it just gets better and better and better and better, and we gradually become a sort of, you know, incrementally a better person, more skillful dancer, you know, whatever, better cook, better partner, whatever. But it doesn't work like that, you know. It works in stages, and it doesn't seem very logical sometimes, you know, particularly with minds. Like sometimes our minds are just, you know, like if you've got a lot going on or a crisis has happened, your mind is going to be really busy. It's going to be really stressed, and it's going to be really actually hard to do something. And so, you know, all you can do in that situation is just hold on to what you've got, you know, hold on to some semblance of practice, hold on to your mindful walk the best you can, and not worry too much about how it's going, because actually it's very hard to practice in those situations. But other times you might find that your mind is more open, you know, like if you've been away on retreat, or you've spent a weekend in an art gallery looking at beautiful pieces of art, you might feel a bit moved, and you know, your mind can have this sort of slightly richer sense about it, yeah, and you can then really capitalize on that, and then your practice will feel like it's going somewhere quite quickly. But it's easy to, when that stressful mind comes back, it's easy to get a bit frustrated and feel as though it's not happening or it's not making any progress. But all that's happening is these phases are just coming up and down, yeah, these waves are rolling in. So another situation is when you have like a bereavement or a loss, like you have a relationship breakup or somebody that you care about dies. you know, for a little, I mean, it's sort of very sad, isn't it? But for a little while, you're really opened up, aren't you? There's a real opportunity to kind of get in touch with something deeper there, you know? But it doesn't sort of last forever, you know? It's suddenly, before you know it, you're sort of just caught in life again, aren't you? Caught in the sort of mundane day-to-day routine, and you've somehow lost touch with that sort of significance of that event. So it's just about... your mind will move between these different states, and that's fine. You know, that there's nothing sort of to worry about there. And it sometimes will feel a bit tough. So particularly, you know, at the moment, I mean, you've all been doing really well. Like, you heard some, you know, like your reports, and I had some emails from some people. You're all really trying to see what's going on for you. And when you're doing that, you suddenly might become aware of things which have been under the surface the whole time. Things that actually are causing you discomfort or a bit of suffering even. And suddenly you're sort of bringing them out, and of course they feel a bit unpleasant because you're sort of looking at them for the first time. But they would have been under there anyway, causing you sort of, you know, just like nipping at you and dragging you down a little bit. And the only way we can move them on is to bring them out and then sort of work beyond them, if you see what I mean. So it may feel a bit uncomfortable at times. It may actually feel very uncomfortable at times. I've had a few retreats which felt really sort of, really didn't want to be there. But I've always come back from them and been convinced they're actually really useful retreats to be on. Actually, they're the ones that often move me along more than the sort of really pleasurable ones, which are just a bit of a holiday or something. So it's worth it, you know. It's worth it. It can take a while to convince yourself, to build up the confidence that it works. So just look for little signs that things are changing, and trust me, it works. Yeah, so it works. The thing to do, I mean, how I think of it is that it's a bit like hammering rocks, you know, trying to break up rocks. Like, you'll hit a rock over and over again and it will seem as though nothing's happening. It'll just feel really frustrating. And then the 10th blow will crack the rock. Yeah, but you need to hit it 10 times before it cracks. It won't crack on the first blow, but it can feel like it's not going anywhere, yeah, to start with. But it will, it is having an effect. So try not to get too frustrated with it. If you get frustrated and irritated, it just sort of bogs you down, and it actually doesn't sort of help. It slows it down a bit. So a good way of doing this is just try not to evaluate too much in the short term. Yeah. So don't try to think sort of week in, week out. Oh, how's this week been? How's that week been? And so on. You're looking for sort of, I'm a scientist, you always look for a trend, yeah? You sort of ignore the sort of upping, like individual ups and downs that happen week in, week out. You're looking just for an upward trend on average, yeah? And that can express as, sort of the things you've been saying really, like a bit more life present, a bit more sort of, you notice a few more things. You notice the birds singing, you notice the sunshine, you notice, sort of a pleasant smell in your house. Just like little extra things that you're aware of. Like particularly pleasurable sensations, a little bit more extra pleasure. It can also express in the sense that you feel there's a bit more you behind things. Like, you feel like your choices are a little bit more solid. You know, you're sort of like, oh yeah, I do want to do that. You know, you're a bit more convinced of yourself. Perhaps you feel a bit more self-confident or something. Just, you can be quite subtle to start with, but you feel there's a bit more of you in it. You feel a bit less scattered. And the other, you know, really good way of checking how you're doing is how you're getting on with people around you. So, you know, particularly friends, family, partners, yeah, they're real pinch points. And there's really, in some ways, it doesn't matter how much insight you think you've got. You know, the real question is, how kind are you? You know, how are you with other people? You know, invariably, the people that I'm most impressed with in life are the kindest. Yeah, so just look and see if you are a little bit better with people around you, a little bit less reactive, a little bit more patient, a little bit more generous. Yeah, just small things to start with, but you know, what are your relationships like? So if you just use those as general sort of tracking things, that they're the sort of indicators of progress you're looking at, not really how you're feeling, because that will go up and down. Yeah, is that Just so before I sort of talk about this week's stuff, I just want to check if there's any questions, because I know people sort of were interested in this area a bit. Is there?
Yeah, you talk about reaction.
Yeah.
You can get annoyed. I don't know if this question is right, but you can get annoyed with things, and you can choose how you react. But then sometimes there are like times when you have some heated discussions with people, with others, and then I'm just wondering when are those okay or not. Like, how do you know the difference between if you're reacting badly or if it's a necessary thing that you're
That's a good point. I mean, generally you're looking for righteous indignation. If you feel righteous, it's not a good way, you know, you're not doing it sort of as good as you could do some ways. Like if you're arguing to kind of win, that sort of thing. I'll talk a bit more. That's actually really relevant to what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk a bit more about mind, and then I'm actually going to teach you a new practice, which isn't in the book. I'm going to go off piece a little bit and teach you a new practice called reaction practice, which would be really handy for that. Yeah, good. Yeah. Is there anything else people want to ask? Yeah.
Are we going to talk about, obviously, this is probably exactly what we're about to talk about, so when we've noticed a lot of our negative thoughts in particular, and maybe they're because we have negative connotations to something from our past or something, are we then going to work out a way to maybe change our negative connotations, therefore in turn making us more positive about...
Yes. So we're sort of going to do that. We're going to start by noticing, and we'll build on that as we go. But again, reaction practice is a good way of doing that. So yeah, I'll talk into that area in a moment. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and when it comes to bereavement and loss, when you say you're particularly open, like, are you thinking like, if you're meditating, should you be focusing on that part of your life, or I don't know.
So again, it's all of these emotions will have a sort of correlate in the body, and you particularly want to notice that. As with most meditations, you're noticing that. So yeah, usually with bereavement, you'll feel it in the heart, and you'll feel sad. You know, you will feel sad, and so you can just sort of sit with that. Yeah, so there's, you know, it's so easy to shut that off and not want to feel it. And then it sort of goes underground and becomes sort of unprocessed grief. But by letting it sort of be there, I mean, it's the same with all emotions, actually. But, you know, bereavement's particularly strong sadness that when you feel it, you let it out, and it doesn't sort of solidify and come out later on in another way. Yeah, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not pleasant, but you sort of need to, that grieving process is a really important thing, to be able to feel those emotions. Yeah, but the value in it is that it cuts through a lot of your sort of ideas and what do I mean here? It cuts through the kind of habitual patterns that we have, because it's quite shocking and we're not expecting it. It can make you see things in a new way, and that can be quite valuable, because you can you'll look at your life differently. You might reevaluate your life in some way. Good. Okay, so to come on to this week's theme, so we're talking about mind, which is called citta in Buddhism. And so it's the first thing to say is citta is not just thought. So it's got a much broader connotation than that. It has got a thought element to it. So it is about our thoughts, but it's also about our general sort of well-being. So it has a sort of active component. So it's kind of like what we do. It also has a sort of feeling and emotion connected with it. And it will also have... a connotation in the body, so it's kind of like our general general well-being or something. I mean, to give you give you an example. I mean, so what I'm saying here is thoughts are never sort of independent. They all the correlates all sort of happen together. So to give you an example, you know, you take somebody that you're irritated with at work. You know, somebody annoys you. Don't know what they do. They squeak their chair along too noisily or something. But you, you know, so you get irritated. So firstly, you have a narrative that says, oh, I wish they wouldn't do that. You know, they're so da 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 da. But it also, you have an action, don't you? You might ignore them, or you might, you know, sort of like staple your papers a bit more aggressively, sort of thing. Or, you know, and you also feel irritated. You know, there's that sort of, as well as the narrative, there's a feeling of that, isn't it? An unpleasant feeling. And then also you, you're tense. So your shoulders are tense, your stomach's tense. And you go around like with all these things, don't you? So what we mean by chitta is all of that. So it's like thoughts don't appear in isolation. It's the thought and everything it brings along with it. Yeah, all the feeling, all the action, all the body tightness, tension, expression, so on. I'm going to go straight for some assumptions now. It's going to get a bit metaphysical. So we so often have the assumption that our mind is basically like a computer, that it processes sort of input from the world around us, and it processes that and gives you a sort of an exact account of what's going on around you. So that isn't true. That isn't true from any perspective. So, as a neuroscientist, I can actually tell you that you know, our sense organs, they've all got. So take our eyes. So they've got these rods and cones at the back of our eyes, and what happens is a photon hits them, and it causes a chemical cascade, which then triggers off neurons. And neurons fire either slowly or quickly, and that sort of slow or quick signal gets passed up to the brain. Yeah. So what you've basically got there is a mechanism which is like a binary mechanism, essentially. It produces a sort of on or off kind of code, essentially. And the stuff in our retina is really sort of imprecise in some ways. It only takes in quite a small amount of information. You know, it doesn't actually take in all that's going on around us. We can't, like, you know, we know that there's a lot of things we see a really narrow band of colours. Actually, you know, our eyes are not very good. There's lots of other wavelengths of light around that are completely invisible to us. So we don't, you know, we don't see those. Our brain can't sort of take them in or process them or anything. And then when this these signals get to the brain, we have no idea what happens to them. Yeah, we have no idea how they somehow coalesce into your actual experience. Yeah, we can sort of tell you like which neuron's connected to which neuron and how that sort of fires, but we've no idea how that relates to what I'm feeling right now. Like, how does this electrical impulse translate to the fact that I feel and the fact that I have a perception of all of you and so on? So, yes, scientists have no idea. No idea. So there's an assumption there that our sense organs give us a direct perception of reality, direct perception of the world around us. So they don't. Yeah, they give an imperfect representation. Yeah, so there's limited information, my brain creates some sort of representation of you, but I can't really quite see what you are completely. Yeah, I've got a sort of representation of you in my mind, but that's just, you know, I just call that representation Lycia, I call that one Alex, but they're just sort of representations. They're not really what reality actually is. Yeah, people follow? Yeah, our organs, our sensory apparatus just don't work in that way. Yeah, there's a lot of interpretation that goes on. There's some really interesting experiments you can do, particularly with your eyes, is that you've actually got a blind spot in both of your eyes. So there's an optic nerve. So the eye is sort of inside out. The wiring's on the outside of the cells. So What happens, so, I mean, you can forget about that, but basically you've got your retina and you've got this big load of neural fibres which go out the back into your brain, but there's no receptor cells in that area where that sort of all those neurons go out. So actually, around sort of 30 degrees in each eye, you've got a blind spot, you can't see anything. But your brain fills that in. Yeah, your brain interprets that and fills it in. You can do this great little experiment where you put a cross on a page and a dot here, and if you look at the cross and move the page towards you, the dot will disappear and it will just be filled out with white page. So our brain is constantly filling in the gaps for us, yeah? We hardly have to look at anything in order to see something. That's not because we see it clearly, but because the brain interpolates particularly all the information around it. So what we're seeing is partly made up by our brains. Yeah. Only the very very centre of our retina, the fovea, has quite a high density of sort of retinal cells in it, particularly like cones, which are the cells we used to see in daylight. All the rest of the eye, they have very, very little. So actually, during sort of daylight hours, our brain mostly creates the coloured image we see around us. We can't see colour in our periphery at all. Our brain adds that in. That's extra. Yeah? So, what I'm trying to get at here is what we think of as real, as an objective, unchangeable reality, is not that. Yeah, is not that. We see, obviously, we're taking in sense impressions, but our brain is adding several layers of interpretation on that. And so that the consequence of that is that all of our experience is filtered through that, and it's like a lens. Depending on what you've got on your filter, it can seem all lovely and golden, or it can seem really brown, grey, and hideous and mucky, yeah? And we can't get away from this. This is just an innate process that happens all the time. Now, Buddhism goes a bit further than that, actually. Buddhism says that the objective world doesn't even exist without being perceived, yeah? So what this means is that there isn't a thing out there. So in some ways, this flower doesn't really exist objectively without somebody perceiving it. Yeah. So you have to be, in order for it to be a flower, someone has to perceive it as a flower. Yeah. Without perceiving it, it can't be a sort of flower. Yeah. That might seem a little bit strange, but there's a really nice bit of converging evidence here from quantum theory. So there's a really famous experiment called the double slit experiment, where you have a thing that produces an electron, and you have a sheet of metal with two holes in it, and the electron can pass through either hole, yeah, and on the other side you have a sort of bit of photogenic paper. Which shows you where the electron lands. And a very interesting thing is if you put a detector on one of the holes, so you can record where the electron is, so you can see the electron essentially, the electron will go through that hole. And what happens is you end up with a pattern that shows the electron went through that hole. If you put the detector on the other hole, the electron goes through the other one, yeah, not the previous one, and leaves a mark there. On the other side. If you don't have any detector there at all, so you can't see the electron seems to go through neither hole and both holes at the same time. What it does is it creates a wave-like pattern, a probability pattern, which suggests that that electron didn't land in either location. Yeah, it was a sort of probability. It was a possibility. It could have landed in either, but because nobody observed it, it didn't decide which one to go in, yeah? Doesn't that sound really weird? It sounds like complete fantasy, right? This is like a really, really famous experiment, yeah? Not only that, it's been replicated thousands of times, yeah? The same thing happens again and again and again and again, yeah? The act of observing something alters its behaviour, Yeah, and this is physics. Yeah, this is not sort of some weird Buddhist idea. This is quantum physics. Yeah, the very act of perception alters the nature of an object, alters the nature of a thing. Now, this has been also replicated on a large scale. So what someone did is they took, instead of slits, they took galaxies. Yeah, so they used a big telescope and they took a light source that was like a bright star. And big things in space, like heavy gravity, things with heavy gravity, actually bend light. And so you could, by using these galaxies as essentially the two slits, you could see which way the light from the star was coming. And yeah, true enough, it had the same pattern. So if you looked at one galaxy, the light seemed to come that way. If you looked at the other galaxy, it seemed to come the other way. And if you didn't look at either of them, the light had a distribution pattern, a probability distribution. It didn't essentially go around either galaxy. Now that sounds like, so bear in mind that this light has been traveling across space for billions of years before it's hit the telescope. Yeah, billions of years, yeah. So that really messes with your mind, doesn't it? You know, like, did that light...
I don't understand, to be honest.
No.
Does everyone else?
That's fine. The only point I'm trying to make is that reality isn't quite what you think it is. Mm. Yeah? That's the only point I'm trying to make. That everything that we think of as objective and solid and real and understandable is not. Yeah, reality isn't very understandable. The universe really isn't understandable. It doesn't seem to play by the rules we think it does. You know, we don't really have any idea about what most of the universe is made of. Yeah, or everything we can see in the universe is about 3% of the mass of the universe that it should be. Everything that we have a vague idea about, so, you know, dark matter, dark energy, anything that we have, you know, even a clue about, only another 20%. Yeah, what the rest of it is, no idea. We haven't even got a theory about what the rest of it is. Yeah. So, in our scientific consumerist society, it's very easy to think that we know everything, and we don't. Yeah, we don't. And that includes our own experience. That includes our own minds. Yeah. It's a whole lot weirder than you think it is. Yeah. Yeah, so that's the only sort of point I wanted to make. So it doesn't really matter if the metaphysics stuff doesn't really interest you. Yeah, I just wanted to get across that thing that it's not all the same. It's not all objective. Yeah, and you can, you know, really down to earth way of looking at this is you know, how we experience time. You know, like, we think of time as just a standard regular thing. But actually, you know, time varies. We all experience time differently. Like, if you've ever had a sort of, you know, if you ever had some wild years when you were younger and did a lot of drugs, you'll notice that, you know, time can dilate, can't it? It can go very, very quickly, or it can go very, very slowly, you know. That last hour of work every day, that seems to really drag, doesn't it? You know, it goes really, really slowly. Whereas if you're, you know, enjoying your weekend, it will go by in a flash, yeah? And we're all experiencing time differently at the same time. Does that make sense? So, you know, we're all experiencing this hour, but for some of us, depending on how interesting you're finding my talk, it'll either be really going slowly or it'll be kind of going along quite quickly. Yeah. So we're all having a different perception of reality right now. Yeah. Another typical one is colour blindness, isn't it? You know, like, some people can see lots of colours, some people can't see so many colours. Yeah. That's a different perception. So it's the same thing with our thoughts, yeah? It's the same thing with our thoughts. So our expectations, our instincts, our perceptions, our beliefs, yeah? They all colour things in a different way and mean that we experience the world in a different way, yeah? So why some people are so convinced that they're right when other people can think that they're idiots, you know? Because actually, for them, it makes complete sense. Because their patterning, their beliefs, their ideas, and their interpretations mean that it's completely logical what they believe in. So always colours our experience, and we can get our thought. Well, very few of our thoughts are actually our own. Like a really original thought is a very rare thing. Most of our thoughts come from like friends, family, our education, society, media. We appropriate them and they fit with us, so we take them on, and any that don't fit with us, we reject. So we appropriate these thoughts from other people. And even a lot of this happens subliminally. So when I was when I was doing my undergraduate, actually, I did an investigation on a psychological effect called the mere exposure effect, whereby simply subliminally showing somebody the same thing over and over again means that their liking of it increased. So, you know, you think about, the most recent example is like Trump, isn't it? So he's, you know, for all his controversies, he got in the media a lot of times. And that familiarity must have done something to people's perceptions of him. You know, simply being exposed to people can alter their views, even if they don't like you, even if they think they don't like you. Exposure is enough to change people's perceptions. Yeah. Again, it's another experiment which has been repeated over and over. Yeah, there's lots. We're all prone to subliminal influences every day. Almost everything we see, do, hear, eat, everything has a small effect on our minds. Yeah. And over time, that can build up into habits and patterns and things that cause us difficulties. Yeah. So what I want, maybe I can give you another example. So taking the example of the flower again. So you've got three different people look at the flower. So one of them is a child, one of them is a botanist, and one of them is a poet. And so the child just sees like a coloured object, might not even know it's a flower, depending on how young they are. But yeah, they just sort of see a thing and they just appreciate its sort of appearance. It's, you know, basic structure. A botanist will be able to tell you, well, you know, that's a so-and-so flower. They can tell you how it grows, you know, which country it's native to, how much water it needs, you know, that sort of thing. They've got more sort of knowledge. And a poet might not be able to tell you much about that, but will tell you about a memory that they had that flower caused of so-and-so person when they're in, I don't know, in Spain or in France or something, and that provokes a whole emotion, you know. So all of these experiences, all of these representations are valid, yeah? And they're all coloured by their own sort of, their own thoughts, their own experience. You know, it's not to say that there's not, if you think of it as just a sort of lump of dead matter, then that's all you'll experience. But if you think about it in poetic terms, then there's much more there. Yeah, there's much, much more there. And that will alter how you react to things. Yeah. And that can, it doesn't need to be a flower. It can be a person. It can be, the things around you. It can be, things on the street. It can be all sorts of things. It can be your own thoughts, your own emotions even. Like, how do you respond to your thoughts? So, I mean, I had a really interesting experience of this on a retreat. So I was ordained last year on a 4-month retreat, and I'd had a bit of a grievance with a friend of mine, actually, and for some reason it really bothered me for months and months and months. It just sort of niggled in the back of my mind, and then one day my main grievance was that I kind of felt like he didn't understand me. So my narrative, the story I had going in my head, was, oh, he doesn't get me, he doesn't see me. And then one day I just realized, that was wrong. I realized that, basically I asked what I was, you know, so what am I? Am I what I think I am? Or am I what other people perceive me to be, you know? The reality is I am all of those perceptions of me. I'm what I think I am, and I'm also how other people experience me. Because even though I sort of think I know myself best, the reality is I'd often upset my friend, and so that I couldn't sort of forget, I couldn't ignore that fact that whenever I was with him, I would get in an argument with him, even though I didn't think I did, but I did. So that was me. So, you know, that perception of me was really valid, actually. And so what I realised is that because I can never know all the perceptions of me, I can never really completely know who I am. Yeah, I can't know what you all think of me. Yeah, I can never quite get, you know, the whole perception of who I am and how I'm perceived. You know, I just have my perspective on it and a few of my friends' perspectives on it, and that's it. You know, and you can really see this in like if you have a disagreement with somebody, because you know there's always two sides of the story, and neither of them are an objective account. You know, you might believe that your account is sort of righter, but they're never completely objective. They're always slightly corrupted or altered by mind, and they can be more or less corrupted. But there's all, yeah, they're never completely objective. So what I want you to think about this week is what we bring to these things. So, you know, our mind will colour, will filter everything. And so working on, you know, we've all got a sort of good sense of Vedana now. And so the next step is to see, you know, what is then happening? Because, you know, we were talking about the gap last week where you have Vedana and then quickly you get into thoughts. What we're trying to see now is you've got your Vedana, so how are those thoughts developing? Yeah, what filter am I viewing the world by? And we're just going to start by trying to notice those. Yeah, we're going to start by trying to notice those. So the thing to watch out for is that we tend to generalize our narratives. We generalize and extrapolate from them. So we tell a story, and the story is often a bit polarized. It's a bit black and white, or it's a bit exaggerated, or it's a bit sort of what do you call it, like a bit conflicting. Like we tend to like getting into you know, taking one side or the other, don't we? You know, a bit anyway, the word will come to me. Are we blaming people? You know, what sort of process is going on? What is the story? And yeah, do we reinforce them? So, you know, like a really extreme example of this is maybe panic attacks. Like if you've ever had a panic attack, it just starts off as like, I had a few when I was younger, and it just starts off as sort of like just an idea. Oh, I feel a bit, my heart's beating a bit quick. And then it just sort of starts to snowball and then it's out of control, and then suddenly you're having a panic attack. You know, you can't breathe and you think you're going to die, but a thought started that, you know. And we do that all the time, but in a more sort of subtle way. And thoughts are really powerful. They're really, really powerful. The mistake we make is we misinterpret them for facts. Yeah, they're just thoughts. They're not actually fact. They're not completely true all the time. And you could say, in some ways, you could also say we're mistaking interpretation for perception. So we don't have a direct, immediate perception of how things actually are. We have an interpretation of how things actually are, and we work at that level of interpretation, not the perception. Yeah? So try and see what your interpretation is this week. Try and see how you're interpreting the world.
Can I just ask you something? Don't we just interpret things to suit ourselves as and when we're doing whatever it is we're doing?
How do you mean? Sorry, say again. So, could you say a bit more?
Well, just thinking about interpretations, you know, they change all the time depending on how we're feeling and who we're with and what we're doing.
They do, but you'll have your favourites. So we'll all have our favourite habitual interpretations. They will change day to day, but often they'll have a similar theme. So, you know, my theme is generally I get a bit irritated. Yeah, that's, you know, I'm not so much prone to, well, I'm a little bit prone to worry, but yeah, mainly I'll get a little bit irritated with people in the way or things not being efficient or that sort of thing. So trying to identify what your favourites are. And of course, they'll manifest slightly differently in each different situation, but they should all have the same sort of flavour around them. You might have a couple of flavours, but notice what those ones are. Yeah, I can.
Of how we'd notice them, you know what I mean?
So what I would say, so you want to ask yourself if they're really true. Yeah, if they're really true. Like, so if, for example, you go back to the example of getting irritated with somebody at work, yeah, say you thought they stole your stapler, you know, so you've got a narrative going on about how they're not very generous, or why can't they ask, or so on. You could ask yourself if that really happened. You know, you could say, okay, well, maybe it was an emergency. Maybe it really happened like that. So you could sort of step out your narrative and say, okay, maybe they really needed it. Maybe someone else took it. Maybe so and so. You know, just try to sort of undermine your thought process. Yeah. What's another common one? So. Another one might be you're feeling very low, yeah, feeling very down. And, you know, often when you're feeling very down, you're mostly preoccupied with why you're feeling down, aren't you? There's a narrative there that's usually like, oh, I'm not good enough. Why can't I do anything? I should be happy. If only I'd done this, if only I'd done that. If you can sort of notice that that's happening, you can take a step back and you can ask yourself if that's really true. Like, am I always sad? Like, you probably find that that's not true. Actually, you can remember sometimes you're happy. You know, are you really useless? Actually, no, there's all these examples when you have been useful. Oh, I've got no friends. Oh, hang on, I do have friends, you know. Like, you just try and undermine your thoughts again, just short circuit your thoughts again and again and again, yeah? Like, what are the habitual patterns, and can you get underneath them? Yeah.
What are the types of labels, so when you give examples of your common one is irritation,
yeah,
or worry,
yeah,
what other things
have you experienced? Well, they're as varied as the human mind, but typically, yeah, things like depression, anxiety, worry, restlessness. They could be positive, yes. And I mean, they definitely will. There will be some positive habits as well, but they're not the ones you want to get rid of. Mm. Yeah. So.
You'll come back next week.
Yeah. So we want to. I mean, it's.
So are we trying to get rid of them? Aren't we just trying to recognise them? I mean, they're going to be there anyway.
Yeah. So. So the first step is to notice them. But once you've noticed them, you may as well, they'll have a grip on you until you can look underneath them. So, you know, this whole course is about loosening up those habitual patterns. You know, this is really the crux of the course. This is what we've been building up to, you know. If you can get underneath your habitual difficult thought patterns, then you can liberate yourself from your own suffering, yeah? But you need to identify what those patterns are. You need to see why, where are they leading you? You know, are they leading you to anger, frustration, anxiety, irritation, depression? Where does that thought go? And can you do something about it? Can you short circuit it? Can you derail it before it gets there? That makes sense? Yeah? You know, you might ask, you know, are you polarized, your thinking? Are you being inaccurate? Like, are you being a bit sloppy with your facts? Are you making generalizations? Are you blaming somebody? Would you think that way if you're in a better mood? Is it just that you're a bit moody today? And would you have that thought if you were happy? That's a good way of asking yourself. You could also ask where you got the thought from. So sometimes I notice that I have thoughts that feel a bit uncharacteristic. And then I sort of realise I watched a movie last night and I've sort of appropriated a thought out of that movie or something like that, you know. And it's sort of, in some ways, it's not mine. But it has a real emotional consequence for me. So by if it's a relatively unusual one, you can see where you got it from and try and sort of reject it, as it were. This is a bit tricky, you know. This is quite subtle. So, you know, in some ways, what we've been doing is we've been building up to this. We've had day-to-day mindfulness, we've had awareness of the body, we've had awareness of Vedana, and only if you've got a good enough grounding in those will you really be able to see the thoughts happening. Yeah. So it might be that you can't quite attempt it this week. You can just get like try and get a good as idea as you can, and then you work on the foundation practices, and then you try to bring awareness to your thoughts later. But yeah, this is kind of where we've been trying to go. So particularly try to notice the running stories. Like if you have if you notice a story more than a couple of times, it's probably one of your habitual patterns. Particularly if it has that characteristic of rumination that we talked about, it goes around again and again and again, and you're not getting anywhere with it. That's probably a good sign. It's one of your habitual patterns. Yeah. Yeah.
If it's something related to an unresolved thing, maybe would you advise? Maybe it's something you have to actually do in life to get rid of it. Like maybe it's a person you wronged, and you need to.
Yeah.
Say sorry, or I don't know.
Absolutely, yeah. If it keeps coming up, then generally you need to do something about it. And it's not, if it is something like a matter of sort of behaviour or ethics, then you do need to act on it. I mean, if you're a Buddhist, this would go hand in hand with the practice of, confessing, telling people that you've, that you're sorry, basically, and that you made a mistake. And, yeah, also sort of working through that process of it. Yeah.
What if it's like someone close to you who you feel has wronged you, but they might never say sorry, and you might never get over it?
Yeah. Well, then you've got to work with on the emotion. So you can't. So you've got to take responsibility for your own mind. So nobody else is responsible for your own mind. Yeah. And some people may never help you in this. But you've got to somehow find a way of letting go of that. Yeah. So we can only do stuff from our end. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't sort of always happen like that in reality. Usually what happens if you loosen up your mind, then you happen to engage with this person in a different way, and then often they respond actually, and things get better usually. But there are some scenarios where you just can't do that. You know, like if it's long ago in the past, for instance, there's no way of sort of resolving it in that way. So you have to just resolve it in your own. Yeah, yeah. But again, that can take a while to work through. What I'd say is, don't take on too much too soon. Yeah, if it's a really uncomfortable negative emotion, and it's really causing you difficulties, you may not be able to tackle it all in one go. You may actually need to go do sort of some counselling or something, you know, if it's a very, very, if it's strong trauma or something. But, try and work on the sort of niggly habitual ones, that you should be able to get a bit of traction on those. And if you've got a good sense, you might be able to take on something a bit more substantial. Yeah.
Kind of feels you're merging with psychotherapy in terms of some of the...
Yeah. Yeah, so some of this course is taken from mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is of course originally comes from Buddhism anyway. So yeah, there are common techniques in these approaches. Yeah. So this is the key here, really. So if we can, if you can change how you look at things, if you can change that lens on your mind, you can completely change your experience. Yeah, the world around you will be a different place. Yeah, so this is the pathway to a richer life. You know, things do change. I mean, if you think about, if you've ever had experience of a deep meditation, or that you even being away for a weekend in nature, you know, you come back and the world seems a very different place, doesn't it? You know, it does really change your perspective on things, and we can do this in our day-to-day lives. Yeah, it doesn't have to just be those particularly special moments. It can. We're trying to do this with everything that we experience. So by changing our minds, we can really change the world around us. And not just in a psychological sense either. As I was saying, it seems that the universe is actually. Does actually respond to how we perceive things. Yeah, the reality is stranger than we think it is. So be open to the possibility of not knowing how it works. Yeah, be open to the possibility of something more being there. What I certainly find is as I practice, I'm more and more confident of that relationship. I don't really know why, but I can see the effects of it, and I'm more and more confident that I don't really know, but something's going on. Yeah. Yeah.
It seems a bit strange though, because like if your reality is what you perceive it as, then it seems not very logical to say these are only thoughts, not facts, because facts don't exist. It's only your perception of things that makes reality real. Mm. So it's difficult to challenge, say, a negative thought by saying this is just a thought, it's not fact.
Yeah.
When in fact,
yeah,
facts are like
waiting
to be disproved.
It's slightly a matter of semantics here. So what we're trying to get at is there's a misunderstanding that reality is completely objective and that it's fixed. So that's what we're trying to get through. Obviously our experience is real. Yeah, this, we are having a real experience. And yeah, our thoughts are part of our experience. So in that sense they are sort of real. It's a little that's like a common stock phrase that's used, but it's mainly there to cut through the sense that we think everything else is unchangeable and fixed. Yeah, so in some ways this goes back to again, this has roots in ancient Buddhism, where there's long teachings about everything being sort of insubstantial, not being how we think it is. But in modern secular mindfulness, it's been condensed down to thoughts are not facts. So yeah, our experience is real. Obviously, we're real. Our experience is real. But our assumptions that the world is a certain way is not. That makes sense? Yeah? Yeah.
I'm very curious about pilots and the neural filling in of the neural connections. I'm just saying it just changes the whole feeling of what pilots used to do often. Do you see what I mean? Because if they're not seeing, if they're making up anyway.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll have a talk about it after, but yeah, slightly more worrying, isn't it, suddenly? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's quite
Woody Allen. Yeah.
That's why computers.
Okay, so I haven't got very long left, and I want to teach you another practice before we go tonight. So your home practice, so if you're doing the mindful walk, carry on doing that, you're doing really well. Just again, try to notice a bit more your thoughts. So when you're walking along, so a few of you are saying you're getting distracted. We're gonna notice that distraction now. We're going to see what the thoughts are. Yeah, we're going to try and notice what those thoughts are when they come up, and see if we can identify our habitual patterns. Yeah. Now, if so what we really need to do is to see mind, we need to start sort of meditating. So if you're already meditating, very good. If you haven't got the practice going yet, try to start meditating, even if it's just sort of 5 or 10 minutes a day, that would be great. 20 minutes 3 times a week, whatever you can do, keep it manageable. Don't try to do something which is too unrealistic, and don't try to do too much in one go, but do try to develop some pattern of meditation. Yeah, so even if it's just you sit down for 10 minutes before you leave the house to go to work, or you know, the first 10 minutes when you get home while your dinner's cooking or something. Maybe not while your dinner's cooking, in case you burn the house down, but you know, try to just find a few minutes to start a meditation practice. If you're already meditating regularly, there's another series of exercises in the book which are actually very good. So if you are meditating every day and you want to just do those for 10 minutes, then you can do those. They're on page 139. But the main thing I want to teach you today is reaction practice. So this isn't in the book. So the book recommends doing a mindful moment, I think. So I'm going to suggest we don't do that. Instead, we try to do reaction practice. So reaction practice is very good when you feel aversive or sort of anxious, critical, those sort of quite strong emotions. It's a bit less good at things like a craving or lust. So you know, try to pick something that's a bit more like fiery, you know what I mean, like in terms of like a strong reaction. And what it does is it it's a bit like the breathing space. Once you notice the reaction, you can redirect it, so you don't get dragged off in it, so you don't get caught in the narrative, you don't act out, and you don't cause yourself negative consequences, even in you know, either to other people or to yourself. So what you do in reaction practice, so the first thing you want to do is you need to notice that you're having a reaction, yeah? So so notice that flaring up of the stories, yeah, of mind. Notice that interpretation coming in strongly, like so-and-so did this, you know, so-and-so did that, whatever, he took my whatever, you know. See if you notice that reaction, or, you know, if you're a bit late or something, you know, and somebody calls you out on it, you didn't, or get a parking ticket, you know, you feel a reaction, don't you? So notice the reaction. First thing you need to do after that is take it off the heat. So don't, you know, try to stop yourself acting out of that, you know, so don't hit the traffic warden, you know, don't get stroppy at the checkout, don't huff at the person in front of you on the tube. So try not to act out. You sort of make a conscious decision not to do that. Now what's important here is you don't feel guilty about your emotions. So if you feel angry or resentment or envy or whatever, that's okay, you know, you're handling it. You don't sort of think you shouldn't be feeling that. It's okay to sort of notice that you're angry in this. What you've done is you've stopped yourself acting out. And then the key thing is to try and stay with that. So try and stay with that feeling. So if that's resentment, try and sort of get up close to it and try and sort of sit with it. Like let it like burn through you, you know, like it will flare up, it will feel like a fireball or something. And you sit with it, but we're not sort of thinking about it. We're not sort of fantasizing or telling ourselves stories or ruminating about it. We're just feeling the sensation as it sort of burns through us. And so in some ways what we're doing is we're getting out of the stories and dropping down to the Vedana. The Vedana will probably feel quite unpleasant, but what you'll notice is that that will probably change. Yeah, we think that these sensations are sort of permanent sensations, but actually as soon as you hold it, it will probably burn out. Yeah, probably burn out. And then finally, you just try and get a sense of what's going on in terms of your mind. So, you know, what is your mind bringing to it? So it might be that you notice that you're angry because ultimately you're a bit threatened, or, you know, your self-esteem has taken a bit of a hit, or that you're, you know, a bit sad or something. So it's not so much a sort of there's a little bit of labelling, it's not so much a sort of thought process, it's more like you sort of feel it a bit more, but it does have a label to it, you know, you do, I sort of feel it, I sort of feel the emotion, and then I sort of ask, oh, what's that emotion? Oh, it's sadness, you know, you sort of feel it about here. But yeah, you're not sort of going into thoughts. Yeah. So that's it, basically. So it's really, really good to use when you think you're going to react to something. Yeah, when something's irritated you, when you're angry at somebody, something's not gone your way, try to apply reaction practice. Really good for work colleagues. Really, really good. Like, I found this practice really helpful. And what you're trying to do is notice what your mind is doing. Notice that your mind has taken, you know, it's felt a bit threatened. So what it's wanted to do is wanted to criticize somebody. Yeah, or something like that. You're trying to notice that sequence. Yeah. So any clarifications on that before we finish?
Just really quickly recap.
Yeah. So notice you're having a reaction.
You do one example.
Maybe
after we've done the recap.
Yeah, okay. So notice you're having a reaction. Prevent yourself from acting out. Sit with the reaction. Get a sense of what's actually going on. What's your mind doing? Yeah, what's your mind doing? Yeah.
Is that in the moment or after the moment?
You need to do it in the moment. You need to notice you're having a reaction in the moment. So it has to have a live sense about it. You're not going to catch it all the time.
But then, like, if someone's waiting for a response from you, is that like you're stepping back from it?
Wait a moment, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, is that like a moment? Hold on.
Yeah.
I can feel a reaction.
Yeah.
Go through it, or is it like,
Yeah.
You stop yourself from, because if you're not going to respond to it, then it's like, okay,
What you'll find is a reaction actually is longer than that. So it might be that you sort of, you know, you have an interaction with somebody and you might sort of catch yourself. You might decide not to act out and sort of, you know, fob them off with a sort of half-hearted whatever. Mm. But actually your reaction will continue because you'll go back to your desk or whatever and then you'll stew and you'll fume, you know. So actually that is the reaction. It's not like the breathing space where it's a quick thing. Actually a reaction will go on for quite a long time after that. And so you're working with that. Yeah, working with that. To give you an example, another one from a retreat of mine. So at the end of a retreat, you do, at the end of every day on a retreat, you do a puja, a ritual. And in the rituals, we do mantras. So we were doing mantras every night. And in one mantra, I was a bit off tune and somebody told me to shush. during. They walked by me slowly and told me to shush. So obviously, you know, it's fair enough. I was really off tune, I got really angry, you know, really, really angry. It's sort of in the moment, I was just sort of shocked. I felt sort of hurt. And then afterwards I was like, you know, and the next day in meditation, I couldn't settle. I was just like, what's going on? And it's like, oh, I'm having a reaction. What's going on? Okay, so hang on the reaction. So felt the anger, felt how, you know, how much I wanted to kill this person, you know. It was the retreat leader, yeah. really, really angry. Just felt it. And then I just sort of said to myself, oh, you're just a bit hurt, aren't you? You know, you've just been a bit humiliated. That's what's really going on. You know, all that anger is just that. It's just like, you know, I've been told off. That's all it is. And it just dissipates. It falls, you know, it crumbles, you know, it crumbles because you suddenly see the reality of it. It's not such a big deal. You're just a bit hurt.
Yeah. But is the retreat leader being a bit judgmental and not accepting?
But we're not judging him.
I mean,
if he's saying, you know, you're off tune, what business is it with him?
Well, in some regards, that's by the by, because he's not suffering from it. I'm suffering, if you see what I mean.
No, I agree. I get your point, but I'm just thinking, well, you know, are we all meant to be non-judgmental?
That is righteous indignation.
Yeah. What his place was.
Well, but that, you see, that is a sort of example of, it's very easy to do that. It's an example of how we can get into justifying our thoughts. Or our reaction, how we justify our reaction. Like we justify that it's okay to be angry at somebody because they're being unreasonable. Yeah.
You know, I wasn't suggesting it was okay for you to be angry at him. I was just thinking about the person his action and
when it is actually wrong.
Well, that might be true, and that there might you know genuinely be something wrong in somebody's reaction.
But it's not the point.
The thing is having a reaction is not productive at all. Like if you go and sort of argue back at them, it's not going to help the situation. Whereas actually, if you completely own your reaction and can get underneath it, then if something does need to be addressed, then you can just go and do that really cleanly, you know, without any sort of charge, without any emotion, without any anger. It can be done really smoothly.
And why do you have to label it? I can understand the sitting with it and just let it explode inside you.
Yeah.
What I don't understand is why is there a need to label it?
Yeah.
For it to dissipate.
Yeah. Because what we initially label it is not actually what's quite going on. What we start with, the initial emotion is coloured by mind a lot. So it's like in my example of being shushed, I felt angry, But actually the reality is that was being fueled by being hurt. So I had to identify that I was being hurt, not that I was angry. That makes sense. So you're trying to get underneath that. So in any situation, you know, like loss or anxiety, depression, what's really underneath that? Why is that there? Do you see what I mean? Yeah. What are the thoughts? I mean, it can be quite sort of subtle and a bit difficult to grasp sometimes. Sometimes you can't even put a label on it. You just sort of feel it underneath. But it's not the initial reaction feeling. It's the feeling underneath that. Yeah. I have a go at it. Have a go. I mean, just go and have a go and come back and we can talk about it more next week. Yeah. So I'm afraid I've gone over time, so I'm really sorry I've kept you all up late.
Wake up early and meditate.
Yeah, I hope that's useful. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.